The Virtually Strange Network presents Strange Days Indeed.
Everybody's smoking, no one's getting high. Everybody's flying, I never touch the sky. There's UFOs over New York, and I ain't too surprised.
For the first time in our history, we're studying something that's studying us.
Nobody told me there'd be days like these. Nobody told me there'd be days like these. Nobody told me there'd be days like these. Strange days indeed. Most peculiar, mama. Roll!
Your premier source for UFO information with your host, Errol Bruce Knapps.
Program 234 of These Strange Days. Indeed, the program that looks at the phenomenon of UFOs and the phenomena that surround them. In studio with me tonight, Bobby Rowley, Ian Rogers, Scott from Brampton, and out there, the controls, Dean Gwilandi, and our featured guest tonight, Ray Stanford. During his teenage years, was, as he says, taken in by George Adamski. And by what he says was his own youthful will to believe the incredible. Ray Stanford was also involved from 1960 through 78 in the study of the reach of his own psychic ability. But he now repudiates the majority of that work as subjective and expresses caution about following such psychic readings as he did during that 18-year period. And during that period, Ray Stanford founded the Laboratory for Instrumented UFO Studies in 1973, assembling a $2 million system of optical and electronic instruments for recording high-resolution optical images of UFOs, along with extreme low-frequency magnetic effects, gravity waves, light spectra, sound effects, etc. He reports that all such instruments have now been used successfully by his project, with the result, for example, that gravity waves from UFOs are now recorded and documented. Joining us on the phone from the Washington, D.C. area is Raymond Stanford, who's agreed to talk to us tonight in order to set the record straight about his life and research, and to share some information about his project's instrumented study of UFOs, which he has finally concluded is the most productive approach to UFO studies, the scientific method. Ray Stanford, good evening and welcome to the program.
Hello, Earl.
How did you get involved with UFOs? It's a question that we often ask our guests, and it's intriguing for our listeners to find that out.
Okay. When I first heard of UFOs, I was 9 years old in 1947, when Kenneth Arnold's sighting occurred on June 24th, and I was immediately fascinated. And when the next September came, I was a little kid on the grade school in the yard in Odom, Texas, at the little grade school there, and I jumped out of my swing and went over to the principal's wife, who was standing there, and I said, "Mrs. Shelton, when I grow up, I'm going to find out what these flying saucers people are talking about are, and I'm going to tell the whole world." She did an about-face without saying so much as a harumph and pranced off without acknowledging me. And, of course, that made me even more determined, so here I am today.
You've been around all of this for a very long time. I guess, in a way, Adamski had some kind of influence on you when you were a youngster, huh?
I bet. He sure did. Yes, I'll never forget when I first saw an article about his book, Flying Saucers Have Landed, in a newspaper in Texas. You know, I was 15 when that came out in the newspaper on October 15th, 1953, I believe it was. And I went down and got the book and pretty soon became a believer. I was at the stage where you tend to rebel against your parental belief system and find your own way. Well, I temporarily was misled by Adamski. I had initially had believed that UFOs might be extraterrestrial in origin. Then I had switched over before 1953 and decided they were secret weapons either of the U.S. government or the Soviet Union. Mm. And then I came back to the extraterrestrial hypothesis, but adopted Adamski. Finally, I went to Adamski in California, visited with him several times, and he actually, believe it or not, he confessed his hoaxes to me.
Mm.
And he liked me. And I think he really didn't want, he saw that I was selling my life out for this, and he talked to me about what he had done and that he had done it for money and so on. And so I quickly pulled away from the Damski. We had some incredible encounters with UFOs on Padre Island with 11 of us present, including three police officers who swore affidavits. And that was on the night of November 6th, I guess, 1954. And I had an incredibly close encounter on Sunday night, October 21, 56, in which an object passed 4 feet, maybe 6 feet above our heads, landed about 175 feet from us, and there were four of us present as witnesses. But because of the strong influence of Adamski at that time, I really believe that I misinterpreted these things as being psi-mediated. In other words, we were out on the salt flats northwest of Brownsville for that last experience of October 21st that they talked about, and I interpreted the fact that we were down there and saw this as that we had been influenced by ESP somehow to be down there. But I now think there was no objective basis for that, that it was merely my belief and my wishful thinking. But the experience itself was quite remarkable and on par, I suppose, with any close encounter of that kind. If you flush out the youthful exuberance to interpret it that somehow we had become buddy-buddy with extraterrestrial space brothers, which I no longer hold that concept at all.
Mm-hmm. And for those listeners who haven't listened to this program on a regular basis, George Adamski was king of the contactees, as they were known back in the 50s, and weren't necessarily contactees, but nonetheless, that's how they styled themselves. How old were you when this thing flew just a few feet over your head?
Let's see, that was 1956, October 21, so I was 18.
18. Did that leave any physical effects with you guys when you were there?
Yes, it did. Now, first, let me talk about the effect it had on the plants in the area. One of the witnesses that was there with us took his wife down to see it. I mean, I'm talking about 30 years later. And the place where the object landed, about 175 feet from us, there was still there a circle about 30, 40 feet in diameter where the plant growth was totally stunted and almost non-existent compared to the areas outside where it had landed. Perhaps this was due to the fact that when the thing took off, it suddenly, I mean incredibly, in a fraction of a second, left a glowing column of what I presume to be ions all the way up from the ground into what I presume would be the stratosphere. Just in a fraction of a second, it went up that fast. And perhaps some of the energy involved in that fast takeoff did something either to the soil, made it more water repellent or something. I have no real idea, I'm guessing. But that was the effect on the ground. Now, it did also affect us in a strange kind of way. Maybe it was excitement. Maybe the effect was subjective. But we had a bizarre feeling after we headed home from this thing. As the four of us rode in the car and went back into Brownsville, this was on the salt flats between Brownsville and Port Isabel, Texas, we had the impression that it wasn't necessary to talk to each other to communicate, and we seemed to be, or imagined that we were exchanging thoughts with each other. Now, whether that was real or just some kind of excitement, and the four of us teenagers were, you know, letting our imaginations run away with us, I don't know. There was that sense anyhow, and I've certainly read in other, even alleged abduction cases, of something similar to this where the persons involved seemed to be under an influence that made them at least feel that they were communicating with each other in a paranormal kind of way.
I've also come across that in witnesses, not necessarily involved in an abduction experience, felt that they didn't need to say anything to each other. They had just shared an experience, and I've seen it put as vibed at one another about it. The water repellent state of the soil is a fairly common occurrence after very close contact with UFOs.
I'm not really surprised. There are a number of things you can do to soil that will change the surface tension of the soil or certain areas of the soil enough that it tends to repel water.
Yeah, well, Bud Hopkins has reported that. Ted Phillips has reported it. The BLT team who've been studying crop circles, Baker, Levengood, and Talbot, have all talked about that. Many, many instances of that. That experience when you were 18, did that start you off on what turned into the psychic thing for you?
Not really. I don't think that did. I was trying to move in the direction of a career in the engineering of rocket engines. I was very interested in the future of space travel.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, in 1955, I had entered the statewide competition among high schools called the Texas Junior Academy of Science and presented a paper called Studies in the Multiple Stage Principle of Rocketry, and had received the first place for research in the physical sciences for the state of Texas in that year. And I was heading that direction, but because of this experience, I came to the conclusion that I could no longer spend my life designing something based on purely so-called reaction propulsion, that what we had seen that night and closely had encountered us was something beyond mere rocket propulsion. And it would be foolish for me to spend my life that way. So I began to toy with the idea of somehow, someday, getting together the funds to put together a really good system of instruments. Now, I didn't really act upon that much except get a couple of cameras until after George Adamski confessed to us that he was not telling the truth and saw strong evidence firsthand that Dan Fry was not telling the truth. And I decided to pull completely away from my former sense of contacteeism and to try to get into an objective approach, which I think instruments is probably about as cold, hard, objective as you can get. Of course, you have to interpret the data. The experience that night really launched me over a period of the next several years in the direction that in 1973 ended up with the real beginnings of a full-fledged instrument system down in Texas at a 400-acre research site that we had with a nonprofit organization there.
From the sound of things, you had some fairly phenomenal equipment down there. I mean, somehow you'd managed to raise a lot of money in order to get a hold of all of that technology back in the 70s.
Yes, indeed. It was quite funny because we would get letters. For example, I remember one letter from Brazil in which someone alleged that we were being financed by the CIA. Well, of course, my response to that was, what in the world would the Central Intelligence Agency want to finance research that could obtain hard data that, if in fact we should monitor alien technology in our atmosphere, would basically put the lie on the UFO cover-up that had been going on for years? Well, actually, we were financed, believe it or not, by some bachelors that had plenty of money.
Mm.
And one of them was a hydraulics engineer that worked in the Middle East. He, at times, was working in Saudi Arabia. He was working in Iran. And every month, he would send us substantial sums of money to finance this research. Also, there was a commercial real estate agent in Austin who could make very nice sums of money as commissions on major commercial real estate transactions. And he was very, very kind and very generous. And there were other persons as well, but mainly most of our finances came from well-to-do bachelors, and that made me appreciate bachelors considerably.
If people are supplying you with the technology that you need to do the work that you need to do, I guess there's a degree of appreciation there.
Yes, yes, there is. It was so wonderful. It was a dream come true for me because we had at hand the equipment that finally was able to get a handle on the physics of UFO propulsion. And we did get results, and by the way, these results have been quietly studied all these years, and I decided last November that it was time to finally begin to work toward coming out and publishing the results that our project obtained. The reason for this was not only that it's high time, but it was also that I had a near-fatal heart attack in November, on November 19th, and after undergoing a stent and medications and so on, I realized that my time may be more limited than I might like, and
yeah.
I need to get busy and put this forward. So I'm beginning to move in that direction. That's one reason I decided to come out of the closet and talk with you tonight.
And we're grateful that you are, Ray. You spent a fair amount of time looking into the Socorro incident down there in New Mexico, where police officer Lonnie Zamora saw something land and had a fairly rough few minutes for his sighting, huh?
Yes, I, in fact, authored a book. It's called Socorro Saucer. It was an attempt to very thoroughly cover this case from every angle. Now, in hindsight, there may be a few things that could have been better covered or that I might have missed, but basically it's a very thorough coverage on that subject, and it was a well-documented case, and my book was about the apparent government cover-up of some physical evidence of the landing, and I want to say that there's a possibility I learned recently that there may be still some evidence related to that case that might throw some light on the propulsive force of that object that I will be getting into further, well beyond what was in the book.
What were your conclusions about that case, the landing outside of Socorro?
It certainly did not have any ordinary explanations. It certainly was not, as Phil Klass initially claimed, plasma that had ripped off nearby power lines and landed in the ravine and took off. And then it was not, certainly, as Phil's second hypothesis, a hoax in order to promote tourism to a town that probably is not the biggest tourist attraction in the West.
Very long, narrow little town, as I recall.
Oh, yes. Then the Air Force admitted that they could not explain it. The intelligence community got involved. I think everybody got involved, but no one has come up with a valid explanation. There has been the claim that it was a balloon.
Yeah, that was one that was around a couple of years ago.
Oh,
it was on the updates
list. That is really completely absurd from a host of different angles. I don't want to take time by going into the details of it, but it really didn't hold any water.
Well, I wanted to mention that because we've discussed the Socorro case on this program in the past, and just wanted to let the listeners know that you were involved with that and a lot of the conclusions that came out of that. Let's go back to the technology that you'd been working with for several years.
Yes. The project was called Project Starlight International. And that's not to be confused with the so-called Project Starlight that Greer has had in relationship to his organization. This is something totally different. We were a subsidiary of the Association for the Understanding of Man, Incorporated, a nonprofit research corporation headquartered there in Austin, Texas.
Mm-hmm.
The first breakthrough came when I was had been to New York to be on an old TV show called To Tell the Truth back in the days when Joe Garagiola was host. And the people were trying to guess who was the guy who headed up a UFO tracking laboratory.
Mm-hmm.
And on the way back from New York on 12-12-77 in the middle of the afternoon, my wife and I observed a small object that was passing the airliner. And I started filming it, and the plane bounced or something, and it was on telephoto, and I lost view. And so I took my eyes out of the viewfinder and looked, and here was a gigantic object out there that on telephoto I hadn't noticed. So I went back to wider angle and acquired it and zoomed in on it, and it was a very large needle-shaped object, incredibly brilliant, that was pulsing light. It could pulse it off the left end or the right end, and objects were moving to and from it, spherical objects with a kind of a dome-like effect on the top, like the one I had first seen and started filming. And then there were approximately triangular-shaped objects that would come around and dock point down onto the bottom of this thing. And there were also some discoidal objects connected with it. And I recorded all of this on Super 8mm film. It was over 1,400 movie frames, and this turned out to be quite an important film. And I published some of it that will be reissued in an updated version on the NICAP network that Francis Ridge has on the Internet. But that was only the beginning, and it really got us fired up. We took our system of instruments, which was mobile, except for the radar, which we also had, and it was licensed and in operation. We took the rest of the equipment on a field trip to West Texas and New Mexico and Arizona in July of 1978.
Mm-hmm.
And this was because I had received a tip from a lady who lived in Austin, whose brother was a physical scientist working at White Sands. She had seen me on my appearance on the Phil Donahue show, and I told her brother about it, who was out of White Sands, and he said, listen, have them sneak around White Sands. We have a directive out here. We are being plagued by these objects, and we have a directive to use every means possible to obtain hard data on these things, and if they'll sneak around, they might be able to have some success, too. It's exactly what we did, and on that trip, for the first time of any non-government organization, we recorded while filming UFOs in broad daylight. We recorded ELF magnetic waves from the two objects. Later on, we also recorded from a mountaintop outside of Prescott, Arizona. We recorded, while filming, a gigantic, like a carrier vehicle with smaller objects going to and from it. we recorded not only ELF waves, but gravity waves with a recording gravimeter that were directly correlated with the functions of the magnetic waves, which itself is quite striking and interesting from the standpoint of theory.
ELF, extra low frequency?
Extreme low frequency.
Extreme low frequency. And how does that register?
They were very low frequency, right down in the area of, for example, the wave that was recorded. We presume the objects that were docking with this thing were so far away, we presume that we didn't receive major signal from them, but that this very powerful wave that we were recording was coming from the huge object that they were going to and from. And if I'm remembering the data correctly, there was 11 hertz, 11 cycles per second, for 6 seconds. And then, oddly enough, there would be about 6 cycles per second for 11 seconds. And then again, 11 hertz for 6 seconds, and then 6 hertz for 11 seconds. It was really quite bizarre. But at the same time, we were recording, along with a WWVB binary time signal from the Bureau of Standards at Fort Collins, Colorado, for correlation, we were recording off the gravimeter, and we were receiving a signal that had exactly the same frequency, and, in other words, it had the same function as the magnetic wave. And this is quite striking. Einstein had looked, in an attempt to find a unifying field theory, he'd looked for a relationship between electromagnetism and gravity, and it wasn't found. But I would suspect that whoever was generating these signals that we recorded that day while making a film of the whole event in broad daylight must have come across such a unifying concept, or we wouldn't have been seeing gravity and magnetic waves that had the exact same functionality.
That takes the average guy like me a moment or three to wrap my brain around that. You've been shooting film and using instruments to record the effects of UFOs for more than a couple of years. Have you noticed this effect in other sightings?
Yes, indeed.
It's consistent.
There is a wonderful example of it. My former wife and I, not my present wife, my former wife and I and my daughter, we're flying back from Mexico City on December 4th, 1980, in daylight. We were north of Mexico City. We were north of Teotihuacan pyramid system there. We were above what's called the Tizayuca radio beacon. There was a gigantic object in the west that had a small object that was approaching from the north. This object was quite bizarre. I won't try to take time to describe it here, but it was approaching this gigantic object that had two beam-like effects off the left end of it that were kind of vibrating, and another effect on the end in the direction from which the smaller UFO was approaching. And I filmed this thing, and off to the left of this tubular-shaped thing was a triangular object. It looked like what I would guess to be maybe a kind of an ion vapor or something churning around it, a big triangular thing. I didn't see with the naked eye, but once we had the film, you can actually see what appears to be totally parallel collimated bright beams that are exchanged at times between these objects as if some kind of communication were going on. But relative to your question regarding gravity, It happens that we were up at, I think it was about 16 or 26, I forget, 1,000 feet, and you could see on the western horizon clouds were covering the ground, but mountains were sticking through the clouds right at horizon. And this was very neat because directly under this big object that I'll call a carrier vehicle or mothership, whatever you prefer, I was filming at 50, I believe it was 54 or 56 frames per second. During 5 frames at that speed, the mountains would optically become warped as though by a gravity-like effect. Einstein has shown that gravity, you know, affects the path of light.
Mm-hmm.
And they collapse during 5 frames, and then 15 frames optically come back up to their normal height. And throughout this long film, the mountains collapse and raise back up repeatedly, again and again and again. Now, this in itself would be possibly dramatic evidence of a gravity-like effect warping the backlighting from the horizon. But beyond that, what is absolutely startling is that you see the horizon with mountains all along it, but the mountains collapse most completely. When I say collapse, I'm talking about an optical warping until they become flattened. They collapse most completely directly under this gigantic carrier craft, and the further you get out from it to the sides, they collapse less. And this happens hundreds of times. This phenomenon repeats in those cycles each time. You see that, in other words, that the warping effect is radial to this big object to which the smaller object had been maneuvering. So here we have electronic recordings of gravity waves with a recording gravimeter, and we have optical recording of the effects of gravity waves upon horizon structure beneath this big object.
And you've held on to all of this for all of this time and really haven't put it out there. Kind of a smoking gun you just shot off there, Ray Stanford.
I'd say so. And by the way, Earl, this is the first for your show because that has never been told publicly before.
Ian and I were sitting here discussing that, looking at each other and asking, well, have you heard that before? No. Have you? No.
No, it was the first time for me. I'd love to see a copy of that film.
You will someday, believe me. It's quite striking, quite startling. But, you know, there is another color daylight movie film that I got that is even more important than that one.
Really?
Yes. This occurred on October 5th, 1985, in the middle of the afternoon, beautiful, sunshiny October afternoon, on the bayfront in Corpus Christi, Texas. My two eldest children and three other adults were on a pier called the Emerald Cove Breakwater that juts out from the north end of E.B. Cole Park on the Corpus Christi bayfront. There were hundreds of people at the park, and I had agreement with my kids that if they ever saw a UFO and pointed it out to me and I succeeded in getting a film of it and it did turn out to be the real thing, that whoever did so would get $10. Now, unfortunately, we're walking out there on the pier and I'm more concerned about them falling off onto the rocks in the water, and these kids are looking up and both of them, unfortunately, at the same time say, Daddy, look at that.
$5 each.
Pointing up. They got $10 each and I got the film of a lifetime. I got so much film that I ran out of film, and after filming a total of 8 objects, I believe, in the event, but I only had film to record 4 of them. It was startling. I don't, at this point, want to go into the details of what was filmed because it skips them some very sophisticated physics, but the film, and believe me, I wouldn't say this unless it will be demonstrated absolutely when this is published scientifically. That is, the film is absolutely diagnostic of UFO propulsion in the atmosphere. It absolutely and completely demonstrates that magnetohydrodynamic propulsion is involved. That is to say that the atmosphere around the objects is being, by some means, ionized, or a plasma is being formed, and it is being moved around the object for propulsion. And I'll show you how the media are about this. After I had gotten the film processed and saw how really wonderful it was, I filmed it at 10 power telephoto. I called the newspaper in Corpus Christi and I said, I'd like your corporation and asked them for persons that may have seen these objects on that date to come forward. And there may be others that got pictures. And the guy said, well, you're going to have to let me have frames from the movie to publish, or I'm not going to carry it. And I said, hey, wait a minute, this is ridiculous. If we release frames from the movie, anybody can hoax the sighting because they'll know what the object looked like, you see, in each case.
Yeah.
But he admitted to me that a young boy, I think he said 14, I could be wrong about that after this many years, had called and said that he had seen an object or objects passing over and had taken, relative to mine, low-resolution pictures. And the reporter told him, well, don't you know you must have photographed a satellite? And the young man came down with his mother, and, you know, they saw the pictures, but he said, well, you know, it's a spot of light in the sky. It must be a satellite. Yes, at 3 in the afternoon, it was a satellite, so bright. Not back in 1985, I don't think so. But his time coincided precisely with the time that all of us had seen the marvelous procession of objects, the last of which appeared quite different than the others. I will describe the last one. The last one, if you took the glass out of an hourglass and put it in a horizontal plane to where it is rotating around that little narrow glass area,
mm-hmm.
And turning counterclockwise at this rate, each one of those is one rotation in a horizontal plane, and covered it with a electrical plasma that would give the pretty mother of pearl colors, such as pink and turquoise and changing and moving. That's what the last object looked like, but it was quite different from the other, I guess, there were seven other than that total.
There've been a lot of descriptions of objects seen in the sky over the years where the witnesses said it looked like plasma around this thing. I've seen footage shot in downtown Toronto at night of an object that is flashing those mother-of-pearl colors, and either it is spinning or whatever is surrounding it, the plasma is spinning.
Yes. What appears to happen, according to the films that we've got, is that there are devices around the periphery of these objects. They may be microwave devices, they may be something else, they may be some kind of very sophisticated high-energy electrodes, but they ionize columns of air, or air adjacent to the object, but they're not continuous, they're segmented, and they fire in sequence, and so one can get the false impression that the object is revolving, just as it may look like a Theodore is revolving when it's not.
Mm-hmm.
But what this is doing is creating plasma, and this plasma is moved by a dipolar magnetic field along the axis of radial symmetry of the object. I base this on the study of thousands of frames of movie films, from the one I mentioned and from 12-12-77 and from quite a few others. We actually will be publishing frames from motion picture films that show a complete inner core of the magnetic field with ions flowing along the lines of force, where you can actually see a three-dimensional two-polar dipolar magnetic field visible due to the ions, the plasma contouring it and emitting light as photons. And it's just marvelous. I mean, also, the 12-12-77 film has a series where a disc approaches the eyeliner with this effect in pulsations around it, and the sunlight, which the sun is up above and slightly off from vertical, and the sunlight is projecting a refraction shadow through this high-energy magnetic field down onto the clouds. The object is about 39,000 feet. The cloud tops are 11, and you actually have what appears to be the refraction shadow through this field on the clouds below, enabling you to calculate the actual size and velocity of the object that was approaching the airliner.
Oh. I'm a civilian, my brain is boggling somewhat, but incredible stuff, Ray Stanford. I have to ask you this. I would be remiss not to, and I know a lot of UFO people listen to this program via the World Wide Web. Why would you hang on to the evidence that you have and not put it out there?
Well, one reason is that is the first place that, of course, I've been head of this operation, and I found it so satisfying that I no longer had the compulsion. Often you want to convince people because you want to believe yourself. Sometimes when you get people to believe you, they are a help to you, really, in believing what you're convincing them to believe. And once we got this and begin to see this, and the more evidence that we got with films and electronic recordings, the more it added to the picture. So it gave me a kind of inner peace to not want to convince other people, probably in order, to convince myself, because I didn't need it. And as we worked slowly and have worked more and more over these years, there have been, I can't tell you how much money. I mean, for example, the one film, the 12-12-77 film that I mentioned from the airline flying back from New York, we spent over $89,000 studying that film alone. But each time we've added more to the picture, and we didn't want to be accused of rushing to judgment, rushing to interpretation. And because events continued and have continued, and we've gotten more and more, there was the desire to wait until you've got a fairly coherent picture of the phenomena from the standpoint of physics. That has been my goal, even though I'm not professionally educated as a physicist. That's been my goal, and I have worked with numbers of world-class physicists and aerospace engineers in interpreting this, but not only because of the heart attack I had, but because finally we've gotten to the stage of processing more and more data from these films and from these electron recordings now is the time to come out with it. Rome wasn't built in a night. This is a big story. And one thing for sure, no one can accuse us of rushing for attention or publicity or anything like that. That's not the desire. It's to present the real story as completely as possible when it's done and not present it piecemeal. Because sometimes if you have to tell a story that is controversial piecemeal, it leads only to confusion, and it leads the media to come out and begin to say things about your data that they wouldn't if you'd been able to publish it as a total picture and explain in detail before they got a hold of it as segments. Can you understand that, Earl?
I understand that, yes. But, for instance, Ian Rogers sitting across the desk from me is looking puzzled.
Well, I'm just kind of wondering, say you decide to release it tomorrow, say you decide to take it to the press and television stations, don't you think they might have the same opinion as if you had rushed it out, that, well, why did he wait 20 years to show us?
Let me say that the media are not the people that are in a position to evaluate evidence. The media have given wide-scale publicity to many cases, in my opinion, that were photographic hoaxes, for example. What you do when you have important data is you very carefully analyze it, work with the right people to make sure that your analysis is not only complete, but that it is objective and reasonable. Then you move forward with it in a credible way of publication, not taking it to the media, but publish it, preferably as a scientific paper or papers, and then come out with popularized versions on top of that. But say it in the most thorough and complete way first, so that when it hits the media, there is not a lot of immediate misinterpretation or misunderstanding. There is no desire on my part or any of those that have worked with me to come out and say, well, I have to ask myself, as unfortunately many UFO researchers have not, is what is the need to know? Is there any urgency that the public know the physics of UFO propulsion? I personally don't believe that there is, and therefore I want to wait until we can present it in a way that it is meaningful to science and can possibly lead to technological breakthroughs, rather than just put something out, gee whiz, we have evidence that an advanced technology is here, where the heck does it come from? And there's nothing in what we have that tells us where the technology comes from. But it strongly suggests that it would be stretching it to say that it had a known terrestrial source.
Do you have not just a method, but a timeline? I'm just wondering when I can look forward to seeing this.
There is not a specific timeline at this time. I've been working with a well-known and quite credible European UFO researcher in trying to get feedback on this from the standpoint of the UFO community and how to best approach this from the standpoint of the scientific side of the UFO community. You know, there are many, many sides and angles to the UFO subject. There is also a scientific and objective side that tries to base analysis upon hard data and to come with factual conclusions. That is first, so there is not a definite timeline, but I can say this, it is my gut feeling that within the next 2 years you're going to see much of this out and open, and at that point, although it may sound incredible now, you will understand that what I've said, that I am in fact understating the case, not overstating it.
Mm-hmm. I guess for a lot of the younger listeners, 2 years is a long time, but for us older guys, it goes by real fast.
Isn't that the truth?
Have you figured out, having seen all of the footage over the years that you've shot, and you figure what you're seeing is real, are you able to look at footage and say that's not real?
Yes. There are distinct sets of phenomena that, much to my surprise and the surprise of those working with me, we have discovered in UFO motion pictures and still photographs, telephoto still photographs as well. These sets of phenomena are present regardless of what so-called type or shape of objects have been filmed. Now, understand, they're not just in those we've gotten. They are present in other people's films and still shots as well. But they are not present in pictures that are fake. In fact, it would be impossible for anyone to fake these sets of phenomena. I'll tell you one of them. First, let me go back to a sighting where there was not film. On Santa Catalina Island off the coast of California back some years ago at a Boy Scout encampment in the summer, a close-range sighting occurred by huge numbers of Boy Scouts. It was a dome disc. They said it was odd because against the blue sky, around this object, the sky somehow looked darker or bluer than the rest of the sky. Well, one might say, well, they were seeing a corona. But the truth of the matter is, if all you had was observation, that would be thought to be the case. But it is not. When you take the film, what you find out is the higher the shutter speed, the more this phenomenon is defined. And what the phenomenon is, I'm not going to go into how this might be done because we don't know, we can only speculate. But around the object, there are negative ghost images of the object in various rotations. And the longer the exposure, the more of these are around it, and they will even overlap each other. The quicker the exposure, the shorter the duration of the exposure, the fewer of these will be seen. In some cases, although they look almost look photographic negatives of it, in a few cases you will actually see the image of the object bigger and clearer than the actual objects you were looking at when you filmed. They're not as solid looking as the real object. They are like, I don't know how to explain, they're like phantoms that were, for example, in some cases, the bright areas will be dark in these phantoms, and the dark areas will be bright, kind of a negative effect.
Mm-hmm.
But there's no way, I mean, it is incredible to look at this, and I can take a Super 8 millimeter movie film, any one of the ones I have, and show you this. I can show it to you in the still shots, and regardless of the shape of the object, now depending on the shape, the array, the pattern of array of these around the object will be different according to the shape. They will not be present in simulated photographs. You don't get this effect at all. So it's a nice earmark, and there are others as well that are quite remarkable and consistent. You can see this effect, of course, as a kind of a darkness around the object, but some of the phenomena are extremely high speed, as you would probably guess if you were trying to speculate about advanced technological propulsion. You might guess there would be high-speed flash phenomena, for example. Quite startling. A young man from Miami, Florida, and he was just a passenger on the plane beside me, he watched as I filmed a UFO over West Texas at the end of June in 1978 as we were flying, you know, on an airliner. And we watched a domed black object out in front of a thunderhead that was hovering out there. And I took a film of it. And when we got the film back, the object looked black. When we got the film back, on only one frame was the object black. Many frames, it was solid white. Others, the top half was white, the bottom half black, or vice versa. It was incredible. There were flash phenomena that were so sharp, the eye did not record them, but was flicker fusing the dark phase of it. But no matter how sharp a bright phase is, if it's bright enough, it's going to register on the film, even though the eye and perceptual system of a human being doesn't see it. So this is another thing that's very important to understand in filming UFOs, is that they may come out quite different on the film than they appeared to the eye when the flash phenomena are fast enough or in the right relationship temporally to one another.
Also, you'll get people who are shooting their friends against the background, pretty mountains or whatever it is, and they see nothing. But when the film is developed, or nowadays when they take a look at the images back on their computer, there's something in the picture. So the cameras invariably pick up stuff that the eye doesn't see. So what you've been seeing is an extension of that. You're seeing the objects up there, and the camera is seeing even more than your eye is seeing as you shoot it.
That's right, and the camera simply does not see the way the eye, human perceptual system, sees or perceives.
Yeah. Boy, this is interesting stuff tonight. I knew it was going to be good, but I like this. Some email coming in here, questions for Ray Stanford, and one from Wendy Connors down there in Albuquerque. I don't know if you're familiar with Wendy Connors, Ray.
Sure, I am to some extent.
Okay, we covered off her first question. She says, secondly, how do you view the field of ufology as it appears today with ufology of the past?
Kind of complex question, but a good one. I think that UFO research needs to get back to basics. I think there has been tremendous distraction by beating the bushes to try to get put it in semi-quotes, Big Brother to tell us the truth. And now, when Big Brother has been lying to you since 1947 or before, I don't know why you want to beg him to tell the truth. I believe, and I think Wendy would agree with this part, we need to get back to some real basics, to studying the actual cases of what is reported. And even if it's physiological effects, we need to look more carefully at these. We need to look at photographs, not just with the computer to see if strings are attached and it's a model. We need to look at it to see if it should turn out to be a real so-called UFO, whatever that animal is. We should look at it to see the physics involved. In other words, deal with the basic issues that there are strange objects out there and get off of the rumor mill and so much sidetracking. I'm very pleased that, for example, that Francis Ridge's NICAP website is putting up so much of the old records of excellent cases. We need to get back and study these, just like maybe sometimes people will say that kids in school need to get back to the basics of education. And I see a tendency that people are finally tiring of the sensationalism, the rumors, and so on, and trying to want to get back to something more wholesome and more readily accessible under normal scientific scrutiny.
And certainly Richard Hall, who's a regular contributor to this program, has said that many times, both on this program and on the UFO updates list. Are you able to stay with us for a little while longer, Ray?
You know how I love to talk.
Yeah. We'll get back to Ray in a moment. I want to bring Bill in, out in the beaches, on the conversation. Bill, good evening. Welcome to Strange Days Indeed.
Good evening. I have a question.
Yes, sir.
Of all the sightings, let's say over the last 50 years, It seems to me that the vast majority are at night.
I've only seen
two or three instances that I've seen reported are in the daylight. What's your opinion on that?
Well, you're right. There have been hundreds of hours of film and videotape shot of lights in the sky at night. Daytimes, for some reason, people don't seem to have their cameras with them. Or the camera doesn't work, or it jams, or the tape won't roll, or it's overexposed. There's a whole bunch. Bill, I don't know.
Or they don't see it.
Or they don't see it.
Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely.
Or they don't want to be seen.
Well, there's that to it, too.
Can't really identify it.
Want to thank you for your call, Bill.
I thank you very much. Keep up the good work. It's very interesting.
Thank you, sir. Yeah, we're totally fascinated by it. Let's bring John Velez in here. John, down there in New York City, the moderator of the Abduction Information Center's website and email list. John Velez, Ray Stanford. Ray Stanford, John Velez.
Hello, John.
Good evening, Ray. Very nice to meet you.
Good to meet you again.
So you've been listening, John?
Yes, I have. I've had my ears on all night, and I hope Ray doesn't take this the wrong way, because I happen to be a stent buddy, but I think that heart attack might have been a good thing, or we wouldn't be hearing all of this stuff.
Yeah, that's right. Sometimes the things we think are worse in life are really
There's a silver lining to that cloud.
Yeah, John just went through that in the last week or so, right?
Yeah,
well, John did.
Friday.
We're Hart brothers.
We're Hart brothers, exactly. And UFO brothers in many ways. I did want to make one comment, because I'd like to give the floor back to Ray. This is fascinating stuff tonight. I think the less time I take up, the better. But I did want to say that I do agree with Ray in terms of getting back to basics and bringing some science and some cool heads and some thought and some rationality back to the study of UFOs. My involvement began back in 1995 with participation in the NOVA program, and the reason why I consented to participate and become a public person was because I thought that this would be an opening to introduce some science into the study of abductions. In all the years that I've been involved, I've been fighting very, very hard to get people to focus more on study, scientific analysis, the kind of work that Ray and many other credible people, good researchers, are doing, and to stay away from the anecdotes and the stories and the sensationalism. So I think you're doing a terrific job, Ray. I can't wait for all this data to be made public, and available. I hope you're going to have this available on the internet at some point.
Let me add a personal note to you. If you're down here in the D.C. area, and I think you know how to contact me, you're welcome to come by and let me show you some of this stuff firsthand if you have inclination and time.
Sure.
John goes down to Washington on occasion. He was down there for...
George Washington University Symposium just about, when was that, about 2 months ago,
right? Mm-hmm. Yeah, so now you've got another damn good reason to go down there, John.
Yeah, and to visit my buddy Dick Hall, too.
Well, speaking about coming back to the roots of ufology, actually, John or Ray, maybe you could take this one. Do you think that a ufologist should have to have any kind of qualifications to investigate unexplained flying objects? I think part of the problem we have right now is that anyone who signs up for the MUFON newsletter and gets the coffee cup feels like they can go out and investigate UFOs, and I think that's probably one of the strongest criticisms is that who are these people to investigate these things, and isn't it better to have qualifications to attach to these reports? What do you think would make a good UFO investigator? What kind of qualifications do you think make someone qualified to investigate this phenomenon?
If I may answer that, I think that one thing we need to keep in mind about person, for example, that are able to go out and interview witnesses and examine cases and the evidence connected with them, let's keep in mind that these people basically are studying reports. And, of course, if there is filmed evidence, that too. They should certainly be qualified if they're going to try to get into interpreting a film or whether it's significant or not. If not, they should let other persons handle that. But basically, we need to keep in mind that there are two kinds of UFO, well, there are many kinds of UFO studies, but they're basically two kinds, in that one is the direct study with instruments, and one is the study of reports. And a person that is going to talk to people about what they've seen needs to have a level-head insight into human psychology, needs to have the capacity to listen not only to what the reporter says, but during conversation, I find as an investigator, it's very important to listen to what they don't say. Sometimes what a person doesn't say in a certain situation can be, at least inferentially, just as revealing as what they do say. And that's very important. I think that a person needs also a lot of good practical training and also some training in ethics of how to deal with people in ways that you don't end up creating more problems than you solve.
I'd like to add something to that comment that I think might address the question a little more directly. Guys like Ray, like Wendy, like Dick Hall, you know, you don't necessarily have to be a scientist, a physicist, an astronomer yourself in order to be a good researcher, as long as that data, such as Ray has done, he went out of his way to raise funds so that he could have film experts and physicists and other people who are scientifically trained go over the materials, supply him with reports, and then he compiles that data and passes it along to the public. So that, no, I don't think you have to be yourself an expert as long as you're performing the work of a, the word middleman doesn't fit, but, you know, to be the go-between between the raw data and getting it into the hands of people who are qualified to study it, I think that's where the ethics and the good working knowledge of how to take this data and get it to the right people, I think that's more important than the person himself being a scientist.
So it's a matter of saying you want someone who's a professional, maybe has some technical expertise, but is also ethical and obviously
exactly.
Objective, of course. You
have
to be skeptical.
And if you don't know how to do it yourself, that you go out of your way to get that material into the hands of people who can do it. You know,
well,
like the Bruce Maccabees and the Jeff Sanios or whoever.
That's the important part. Like, this doesn't have to be a one-person stop, like what Ray was saying. Not necessarily everyone who's going to have technical expertise is going to be a people person and be able to interview witnesses. So it's good to have a team who excels in various different areas.
May I go back for a minute to the call that we had from Bill?
Yes.
He mentioned that it seems that a lot more people report UFOs from nocturnal observations than diurnal observations,
mm-hmm.
as far as daylight observation. And you might find it interesting that of all the motion picture films that we've got in our project, actually, my personally getting motion picture film goes back to 1959, but in all of these, only one of them is a nighttime film. It was from an airliner looking down at three UFOs involved in some activity near a lake in Texas when I was flying down to Austin from Dallas. But what we learned on our project from both extensive nighttime watching and daytime watching is, believe it or not, there appear to be more UFOs in the sky, potentially visible in daytime, than at night. And I don't know if this is something deliberate on the part of UFOs or not, but you see, because of the human visual system and the way we see things, it's easier to notice things at night. And it's much less likely when you're out in the daytime, you're looking at the things around you, and it's not like a light against a dark sky. So it's harder to notice them. We may hear a jet relatively close and look for it, and of course its sound will be behind it because it takes the sound a while to reach you behind where it should be. And so what I'm saying is, I really believe, based on our experience in the project, that there are more UFOs out there and visible potentially in daytime than there are at night. And I think our track record of watching both the night and day and getting far more in daylight is possible evidence of this.
I also feel, though, Ray, that for some reason, somehow, you are a UFO magnet. You know, it seems to me that they regard you with a degree of optimism for getting the information out there. I know that's a weird thing to say for me, but that's it just occurred to me. You certainly do seem to pull in a lot of those sightings,
it's
don't you?
It's a nice idea, Earl, but I'm skeptical about it.
Ray, an email here from Michel Deschamps. Please tell Ray that I haven't forgotten about him. Michel Deschamps is up there in Sudbury, Ontario. He says he promised you a copy of the Unsolved Mysteries segment on the Lonnie Zamora UFO landing case as a thank you for the autographed copy of your book that you sent him a while back.
I appreciate his remembering that, because I certainly forgotten.
Yeah, Michel remembers all kinds of amazing stuff. He regularly contributes either by phone or by this here monitor. We have a few minutes left. Is there anything that you want to say that needs to be said?
Okay. I'd like to say that I believe that I'm not special. I carry a camera. This makes me conscious of the sky and the potential. Doing that is extremely important in getting you to watch and potentially see something. I'm a dinosaur track researcher, and a geologist came over here that lived in this area all his life, where I find dinosaur tracks. He had not found any in his whole lifetime. Once he saw my collection, he went out the next day and found a wonderful track. Now, this is because he had the right search image and was conscious now that it was possible to find such tracks. Likewise, I think if people will get their cameras ready and be conscious that they, too, can get this evidence, that they're much more likely to actually be observing and see something. Just having the camera makes you want to be more observant, because you can have the gratification of getting a video or a film. I hope that if anybody gets such, that they will communicate with persons that are capable to analyze and look at this material. If anybody wants my help with anything, they can reach me at dinotracker, dinotracker, at earthlink.net. And that would be my suggestion. Is, in other words, you too can get out there and get films if you are alert to watch the sky and focus your eyes distant when you're out there on clouds and things. Otherwise, you'll be unconsciously focused close by, and it's harder to notice or perceive what's out there.
John Velez sees a lot of stuff in the sky over his home on a fairly regular basis. Right, John?
I have hours and hours and hours of video, all daylight stuff, of spheres, discs. I had one sighting that I was unable to get on video that involved about 10 or 15 of these objects, including a large white boomerang. And yeah, I have hours and hours and hours of that stuff that I've gotten right from my backyard here in New York. I've been telling people for years, all you have to do is look up.
Well, John's the living proof there of just what I said. That's exciting, John. If you come down to see mine, bring some of yours, too.
Yes, sir.
I'll show you yours if you show
You'll
me
show
mine.
Me mine.
yeah, mutual video and film admiration society. Ray Stanford, I want to thank you a lot for coming out tonight. It's been a long time since you've been heard from. I hope that you have, in the course of the last 2 hours, answered a lot of questions that a lot of people in the field have had. And I'm sure that they, like us here in the studio and our listeners, look forward to seeing that footage and a lot of your results of the research that you've been doing. It's been 30 years now with this technology.
That's right. I want to promise people that I'm going to make every effort. Now that I have had the heart attack and realized maybe my time, my days are numbered, I want to get this stuff out there and not die and leave it to somebody else. I'd like to get to work.
And we look forward to seeing the results of that. If there are things that you want to tell people, it doesn't have to be for 2 hours. You're welcome back anytime.
Well, thank you. I appreciate that, Harold.
Thanks, Ray. Good night. And John Velez.
Informative and fascinating program.
Wasn't it? I mean, trying to wrap my head around a lot of the science and the descriptions, you know, I like mind movies, but there were a few tough moments. I want to thank you, John.
You're very welcome.
Good night.
Good night.
Ian Rogers, what do you think?
I'm more curious.
I'm going to put you on the spot because you've been...
I'm not sure about him
all evening.
I just want him to convince me. You know, the best way to convince me is to show me the evidence, to show me the information. As a testimonial, it's very interesting, but it's like a knock on the door that I want to know if it's worth answering.
Yeah. Well, we'll see you next week, Ian Rogers, as we will Bobby Rowley.
Good night.
And good night, Bobby. Good night, Ian.
Good night.
Scott from Brampton.
Good night.
And Dean Gwilandi out there. Don't forget to go to www.virtuallystrange.net. Click any of the pages there and digitally sign the petition for full UFO disclosure to the United Nations. Good night.
That's this week's edition of Strange Days Indeed, hosted and produced by Errol Bruce Knapp. The executive producer is Dean Mascardelli. Send any questions or comments to sdi@virtuallystrange.net. Strange Days Indeed is the copyright of Random Fit Productions. Join us again next Saturday for more Strange Days Indeed from the Virtually Strange Network. Good night.